Shavua Tov, ladies and gentlemen.
Should we wait for Rabbi Weinfeld?
Thank you so much for coming out. I know it's a night that everyone has somewhere else to be. I promise that I will have you out within an hour so that you can get to wherever you need to go, which also includes me. Oh,
the hand up?
So, my topic is not Kristallnacht, but it behooves me to say a few words about it nonetheless. I think everybody in this room knows, but it's still valuable to try to remember exactly what the point is of this gathering commemoration. As I've been trying to explain to my students a couple times over this past week, 80 years ago, during a roughly 24-hour period, more than 1,000 cities, towns, and villages throughout Germany saw spontaneous demonstrations. More than 1,000 synagogues, some in towns already devoid of Jews due to deportation, synagogues destroyed without Jews, and about 7,000 Jewish businesses were destroyed and looted. Many cemeteries, thank you, Rabbi, many cemeteries were desecrated. Thousands of Jewish homes were burned and destroyed. Photos show police and firefighters standing by while synagogues burn and businesses are looted, often led by SA paramilitary stormtroopers. Some of them were in their uniform brown shirts, some in civilian clothing. Many of them had lists and clipboards provided to them to facilitate the identification of Jewish sites. Some of those who were participating were school children. And when the fires threatened neighboring non-Jewish properties, photos show rioters smashing synagogues with hammers and axes and firefighters training hoses on adjacent non-Jewish businesses to keep them wet so that they wouldn't catch fire in order to protect them. More than 30,000 Jewish men between the ages of 16 and 60, that's a quarter of all Jewish men still in Germany, were arrested and sent to Dachau and other concentration camps that had been established in the early months of Nazi rule to incarcerate political prisoners originally, and where they were tortured. More than 1,000 of them died. Jews were attacked everywhere 80 years ago, and 91 were killed. And I always find this, you know, part of the fascination with this event is that because this wasn't yet wartime, the events were widely reported in the international news media. There wasn't a kind of a wartime news blockade that made it hard for other people to find out about it. It was all over the press. The thing I want to focus on briefly before I get to my topic is just the span of time. Kristallnacht did not happen out of the blue. It didn't happen suddenly with no warning. There was really an almost six-year period since the Nazis took power that allowed them to develop the process that led to Kristallnacht. I was actually, you know, my son had an event in school, and so, you know, last night he lies down in bed with me and he starts asking me about Kristallnacht. He's in sixth grade. And it was the first time I really had to sort of explain things to him. Like, my kids, I think they know what I do, but I don't really talk about it a lot with them. And I tried to explain that the incremental process over a six-year period. I've been trying to explain to my students this week as well that you have to understand 6 years, almost 6 years, in history is a blink of an eye. It's a line in a history book, right? But 6 years in a person's life is 6 years in a person's life. I'm telling my 19, 20-year-old students, imagine where you were 6 years ago, what the world was 6 years ago, right? And I think that allows us to understand a little bit more what this slow, incremental process was like. And I think more than remembering what Kristallnacht was about and the threats to, you know, synagogues were targeted because they are the embodiment, essentially, of our identity and our continuity in history. More than that, it's understanding that this was this incremental process that developed over this period of time. Please come in. There's plenty of seats. And obviously, This is on our minds because of the events 2 weeks ago. I think everyone's sensitivities are heightened. The Kristallnacht commemorations this year all over the world, not just because it's a round anniversary, but also because of Pittsburgh two weeks ago, I think is really making people really pay attention. And again, bless you, I think the thing that we need to pay attention to is that slow incremental process, the breakdown of society that allowed these things to develop and occur. As something of a bridge to my topic, not really, I have a handout which I was so taken by it and somewhat shocked by it that I wanted to make copies available. Thank you, Rabbi Freiberg, for making the copies. There's probably not enough for everyone. I actually wasn't expecting such a large crowd. Thank you so much to regulars and new people. But the bridge is this. This is an op-ed piece by Elie Wiesel, and if you read it, it reads like something that could have been written over the last couple of weeks. I'll highlight just a couple of... titled "And Now Istanbul." The latest pogrom in the second paragraph is despicable on more than one level. The killers did what enemies of the Jewish people have often done before. They chose the synagogue as their target. Is it because they knew that Jews alone would be there, or because they sought systematically to assassinate what has remained a symbol, if not the symbol, of Jewish survival throughout centuries of persecution in exile? And just skipping ahead to the last column, first full paragraph, anti-Semitism is contagious. The racist, the bigot, the fanatic begins by hating Jews, but does not stop with Jews. This much we must have learned from history. When Jews are attacked, the entire human community ought to feel unsafe. As Franz Kafka put it, when a Jew is beaten up, it is humanity that is falling to the ground. So I was just struck by this because it wasn't written in the last 2 weeks. It was written 32 years ago, right after a horrible attack in a synagogue in Istanbul, and every single line in this op-ed could have been written in the last couple of weeks, except not exactly by Elie Wiesel, because of course he's no longer alive. So that's a little bit of a bridge to tonight's topic. I planned this a little bit ago, and in retrospect I thought of switching gears and talking more about sort of the meaning of Kristallnacht today, but I'm going to stick with my topic as announced, which was Elie Wiesel, Israel, and the ghosts of the Holocaust. And I want to give a little bit of a disclaimer. I'm not really talking about politics tonight. I'm talking about literature. Two novels and what we can get out of them in terms of Wiesel's view towards the state of Israel. So in terms of sort of the political implications, that's the big shift from talking about what I could talk about. It's part of my broader research. I'm interested in it. And I've been looking, for example, at Wiesel's journalism back then and later to try to get a better sense for some of his political views. I also discovered that a colleague of mine is working on some of these similar issues, which was really exciting for me. This is also a good time for me to just thank everyone and to thank Young Israel for hosting me once again. This is my eighth time doing this for Kristallnacht, and it's given me an opportunity, even though I don't get any time to do my research anymore, I always have to do something in order to get ready for this talk. So I appreciate it because it keeps me honest and keeps me busy. So the state of Israel, longed for, imagined, and realized, represents an inescapable reality that made considerable demands on Elie Wiesel throughout his life. Wiesel was a dedicated advocate for Israel, but he was also criticized, especially later on, for what some thought was an uncritical support for Likud policies and a blind spot when it came to Palestinian suffering. In my brief remarks, I want to compare two novels, Dawn and A Beggar in Jerusalem, that represent key aspects of the late author, Holocaust survivor, and public figure's published reflections on the Jewish state and highlight critical views on Israel as refracted through his fiction. So the first novel, Dawn, published in 1961 in English and French, it's titled L'Aube, in 1960. It's his first novel, book-length thing he published after Night, his memoir. It's set in pre-state Palestine, and it in many ways introduced the subject and challenges of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel. His protagonist is named Elisha. He's 18 years old, shares a name with the Wiesel's son, as well as other characters in the author's corpus. The name recurs in a number of his books. The character is an orphan survivor recruited by pre-state Zionist resistance after liberation from the camps. And think about for a moment his namesake, right? Elisha was the disciple of Eliyahu Navi, the harbinger of Mashiach. Elisha was famous for bringing a boy back to life, and which is ironic because the character here is essentially selected to be a killer. He's an instrument of retaliation against the British. The British mandate has captured a Jewish member of the resistance and announced he would be hanged at dawn. And the protagonist, Elisha, is chosen to be the executioner of a captured British captain in direct and simultaneous retaliation, should the British follow through on their threat. So this war of wills is the setting for the novel, which takes place over one long night, where the character Elisha has to kind of come to terms with what he's about to do and the political implications of what he's about to do. Not surprisingly, the brief review of the novel in the New York Times by Herbert Mittgang at the time was titled "An Eye for an Eye." So the novel unfolds over this long night of reflection and flashback in a very unspecified hideout of the resistance cell. We never really know exactly where in pre-state Israel this is taking place. It's always, the entire novel is very sort of strangely dislocated. Dawn, the title of the book, is a story of alternate possibilities and doubled reflected identities. And there are all these doubles going on constantly. The condemned men obviously mirror each other, that they're going to be, you know, executed at the same time. Elisha and the captured British captain that he's slated to kill also mirror each other. Elisha and the apparition of his younger self reflect each other. And even, I would say, Elisha and the author, Elie Wiesel, are doubles in a certain respect. Wiesel brings this character to reality as representing a road not taken. He said this himself. Not only a road that led directly to Eretz Yisrael after the war, but also, as he wrote in a preface, a new preface that was published in 2006, the path of a survivor struggling to act morally in a compromised ethical environment. And it's worth looking at his new preface in detail. It's very, very interesting because he's reflecting much, much later on why he wrote this novel and what he was thinking. Obviously, he writes, "I did not live this tale, but I was implicated in its ethical dilemma from the moment that I assumed my character's place." And he goes on to ask rhetorically whether or not, had he been sent to the Holy Land, would he have been able to fight and even kill for the right to a Jewish state? The Holocaust looms large in this tale. He wonders how he himself might have emerged from the Shoah if he had spent 2 or 4 years in the camps instead of just one. That's his language. Or if he had been appointed capo, again, his language. Extending his inquiry, he reflects more philosophically about cycles of violence, asking, quote, "Can terror coexist with justice? Does murder call for murder? Despair for revenge? Can hate engender anything but hate?" And finally, Wiesel writes, "Dawn aims to put on guard all of those who, in the name of their faith or of some ideal, commit cruel acts of terrorism against innocent victims," even while concluding, "And yet this tale about despair becomes a story against despair." I'm going to come back to this issue of how he turns it around in the end, because it took me a while to try to figure out how that could possibly be true. So one thing we have to just listen to is that this language, when he uses these terms, terror, terrorism, things like that, he's referring to the Jews, And he's not making any kind of apologies for it, but he is talking about the necessity of this kind of activity. Elisha, his protagonist, it should be noted, begins the novel as the antithesis of the survivor persona. Indeed, Dawn precedes the rise of the survivor hero figure in post-war Jewish culture. It's really important to try to get into this mindset. 1960, there wasn't really yet this idea of the survivor. That, you know, a lot of people have actually said that that concept, the survivor, this person that we regard with this great deal of respect and admiration and awe for their accomplishment of surviving, that didn't happen right away. And Wiesel himself was responsible for really creating that persona, a lot of people would argue. Deeply troubled by his own ghosts, Elisha, the character, uncaring as to his own life or death, he's recruited by God, a Sabra and his implied opposite, for this Jewish underground group actively resisting British occupation. In Elisha's own words, God had made me into a terrorist. That language is in the book. Dawn charts Elisha's inner conflict, pitting conscience against duty, and duty wins out. Elisha becomes a man who will be forever tormented by his act of murder, even as assisted by that act, the collective for which he acted, Israel, draws closer to its own national rebirth and freedom. So, Dawn, it's an interesting title, it ushers in a new light and it ushers in a new darkness. And it's really two sides of the same coin. On one hand, we have the new Jew, no longer innocent, willing to fight and die for sovereignty in the land of Israel, determined to do whatever it takes. As God instructed his trainees, the commandment, "Thou shalt not kill," this is from the novel, was given from the summit of one of the mountains here in Palestine, and we were the only ones to obey it. But that's all over. We must be like everybody else. Murder will not be our profession, but our duty. In the days and weeks and months to come, you will have only one purpose. Again, this is the commander talking to his cell. You'll have only one purpose, to kill those who have made us killers. We shall kill in order that once more we may be men. In previous operations, during his training, Elisha imagines himself in the uniform of an SS officer, and he feels sick. In the course of the long night prior to the execution of the British captain, his name is John Dawson, Elisha sees the images of people from his past, including his parents, teachers, even a pre-war vision of himself. And that boy that was him tells him that they're all there, all of these ghosts are there to witness and participate in Elisha's transformation into a murderer. Quote, "You are the sum total of all that we have been," said the youngster who looked like my former self. "In a way, we are the ones to execute John Dawson, because you can't do it without us. Now do you see?" So prior to the execution, Elisha, who's been talking to his victim, muses, "Why do I hate you, John Dawson? Because my people have never known how to hate. Their tragedy throughout the centuries has stemmed from their inability to hate those who have humiliated and from time to time exterminated them. Now our only chance lies in hating you, in learning the necessity and the art of hate. Otherwise, John Dawson, our future will only be an extension of the past, and the Messiah will wait indefinitely for his deliverance." End quote. At the appointed hour, dawn, Elisha follows through on his grim task and shoots the British officer, and it changes him irrevocably. "That's it," I said to myself. "It's done. I've killed Elisha." So he says he's killed himself. The protagonist has become murderer and victim in one. Dawn ends with this surviving witness to the Holocaust, reborn as resistance fighter and murderer, fearing the tattered fragment of darkness that is his own face in the window. Okay, so it's a pretty grim novel. Dawn was published well after Israeli statehood was secured. And we therefore have to read it as a purposive statement on Jewish agency after the Holocaust and on the toxic legacy of genocide. He said it at that time, you know, looking back about 13 years, for a very, very particular reason. It's a what-if scenario. And it dares readers to judge the survivor who has lost everything for his act, which is never construed as revenge. Not once in the novel is anything, you know, the Holocaust appears as these ghosts of his family, but it's not anything. No, at no point does he say, like, you know, I'm shooting John Dawson because of what happened in Europe. There's no framework of revenge there. And so I want to say that if this novel is transformed into a story against despair, as Wiesel introduces it, this redemptive message might be found in the grim determination of a group of Jews doing whatever it takes and accepting the enormous personal cost for the sake of the state and especially what it represents. So, Le Mendiant de Jerusalem, published in French in 1968, in English in 1970, as A Beggar in Jerusalem, is an award-winning novel that many consider Wiesel's finest work. It was written in response to the miraculous victory in 1967 of Israel's army against its neighboring Arab countries. And it was written pretty fast also. We realize if it was published in French in 1968, he cranked it out. He clearly had, I don't think he struggled a lot with this one. Replacing Dawn's undefined setting of an episode in the Jewish resistance pre-state guerrilla war against the British Mandate with a clearly defined, newly accessible setting of the Western Wall Plaza in Jerusalem's recently liberated Old City. This novel, A Beggar in Jerusalem, has a protagonist like Elisha in Dawn, who is a Holocaust survivor. His name is David, the titular beggar of Jerusalem, although he's not really a beggar. He never really asks anything of anyone. And it focuses primarily on a story of friendship that the protagonist David has with a young man named, well, actually not so young, with Katriel, who's a Sabra, and who turns out to be a veteran of the siege of Jerusalem 19 years earlier. He's a reserve soldier, and he's missing and presumed dead following the Six-Day War. So he kind of appears only in flashback form. In the present tense of the novel, Katriel is missing. That story of the friendship between the protagonist David and Katriel, the missing reserve soldier, is interspersed with the dramatic narrative of the army's capture of East Jerusalem. It's really a very thrilling kind of narrative. The national anxiety and international solidarity preceding the war, and flashbacks to David's Holocaust experiences, some of which, like Elisha's in Dawn, imitate episodes in the author's autobiography. And one of the things I've been trying to track is all of these appearances in novels of episodes that actually happened to Wiesel, and just trying to understand sort of how he uses his experience and how he doesn't, or how he goes in different directions. For example, there's a huge exception in Beggar in Jerusalem because the character David survived the Holocaust due to the efforts of a non-Jewish woman who hid him and sacrificed herself to save him. And she may be a little bit based on the Wiesel's own, there was a kind of a cook woman, a non-Jewish woman who helped them, and who very famously, when they were about to be ghettoized in Sziget, she came and said, please come to my home up in the mountains. You know, your whole family, I have room for you. You know, you're going to be safe there. And they didn't. They didn't go. And I think that's kind of part of maybe some of this backstory. But so David's namesake is, of course, the famous Jewish king, ancient conqueror of Yerushalayim, progenitor of Mashiach, who himself makes an appearance in this novel, brought before God to explain why he had followed the 6 million to Jerusalem, trying to force God's hand again. And of course, also father of Shlomo, who built the Beit HaMikdash, the site of which is just east of the setting for this novel's narrations. The site whose capture, as the climax of a lightning military victory, as you all know, sparked a certain degree of messianic fervor for many Jews and non-Jews alike. So this name David is really, you know, apropos. But this David is not a soldier, though he insists on joining the army for its climactic battle for Jerusalem. And he does this by something that, I don't know, probably could never really happen, although you wonder, maybe in the Israeli army, maybe it could have, by basically walking in and talking his way in to the commander, whose name happens to be God, another God, right? David is a survivor of the Shoah. He is convinced he will not survive this battle. He may have something of a death wish, so he may have some of Elisha's sort of qualities of like willing to kind of lose it all. But in the end, it's his friend Katriel that disappears and is presumed dead, and David survives. David survives, but spends his days and nights in the shadow of the Kotel. With a motley crew of social outcasts like him, recounting various fantastic tales, real and imagined, and keeping Katriel's memory alive. Like Dawn, a beggar in Jerusalem develops the powerful conceit of the doppelganger, right? The double character. David and Katriel mirror each other. David and the author mirror each other, particularly in those autobiographical passages. And at the heart of the novel, there's this strange and cryptic parable that's recounted by Katriel. And it's my favorite part of it. I want you to listen to it, and then at the end, I want you to tell me what you think it means, because I find it so perplexing. So it tells a story of a man who leaves his village in search of adventure. And while he's sleeping, it's a long journey, so he goes to sleep in the forest, and he takes off his shoes, and some practical joker comes by, like in the middle of the forest, but okay, and turns his shoes around 180 degrees. Right now, that's because the traveler, he's like, he has no way to get his bearings, so he points his shoes in the direction that he's going. And the joker turns them around. So the traveler wakes up in the morning, right, puts on his shoes, and starts walking back in the direction from which he came, not knowing, right? And soon enough, he starts recognizing territory, he approaches a town, he's like, wow, that looks just like my town. That looks just like my house. Wow, the lock is broken, just like my house. Wow, the woman is yelling at me just like my wife yells at me. It says that, I'm not making it up, right? So he remarks on how familiar everything seems, how he can anticipate where everything is gonna be, and what anyone is going to say to him, even down to the food that this woman who seems to think she recognizes him is serving him. He sits down at the table. I'm quoting now. The children smile at him, and he's overwhelmed by sadness. The smallest one clutches at his knees, plays with his beard, and whispers in his ear, "You'll stay with us, won't you? You won't leave us, will you?" Because he does not want to disappoint the child, and because he feels that it's no use, he's trapped. The stranger caresses the child's golden hair and ends up promising him everything. End quote. So, up until this point, this tale sounds like one from the wise men of hell, right? But then, Cotriel, his friend, adds, and this is the part that really throws me. Cotriel adds, and I'm quoting again, "Yes, he kept his promise. He never returned to his village. Death went looking for him there, but did not find him." And I'm just so blown away by this. You want to scream. It's like, but it is his village. What do you mean it's not his village? What do you mean he never went home? What? Did he not really return to his own village? Like, did his shoes get turned around again? Is the point that the experience of leaving itself changed the traveler irrevocably? Right? So that even though he's back home, he's not, right? And, you know, of course, I think that's the parable for the survivor here, right? And later, while discussing the tale with Cotriel, David really didn't like this story, and he's giving his friend a really hard time about it. And then David realizes the traveler might be him. And I'm quoting again, "I had remained over there in the kingdom of night, a prisoner of the dead. The living person I was, the one I thought myself to be, had been living a lie. I was nothing more than an echo of voices long since extinguished, nothing more than a shadow stumbling against other shadows whom I was cheating and betraying day after day as I forged ahead. I thought I was living my own life. I was only inventing it. I thought I had escaped the ghosts. I was only extending their power. And now it was too late to retrace my steps." So I read this as a kind of parable of what some people have called survivor guilt, a sense of living a false identity, of impersonating someone else, of the struggle, this issue of like the doubling of characters that is actually doubled within the persona of the character himself. He's literally in two places at once. One way that a beggar in Jerusalem deepens Wiesel's attitudes towards Israel is the character of Jerusalem itself, especially the Kotel. Meeting place of heaven and earth, life and death. Jerusalem itself participates in the mirroring that has, I think, clearly become a hallmark of much of Wiesel's fiction. Early on, he writes in the novel, "Jerusalem, the city which miraculously transforms man into pilgrim, no one can enter it and go away unchanged. For me, it's also a little town somewhere in Transylvania, lost in the Carpathians, where, captivated as much by mystery as by truth, a Jewish child studies the Talmud and is dazzled by the richness, the melancholy of its universe made up of legend." And later on, David's friend notices, "You're shaking. So am I. It's because of Jerusalem, isn't it? One doesn't go to Jerusalem. One returns to it. That's one of its mysteries." So indeed, when David finally sees the wall for the first time as it's being overtaken by the IDF, he remarks, "I had never seen the wall before, yet I recognized it." Probably because he had pictures of it. But "I looked at it as one looks at someone from whom one has been forcibly separated a long time, perhaps forever." And then he sees countless people of all types ascending toward the wall, toward all that remains of their collective longing. Just like long ago at Sinai, when they were given the Torah. Just like a generation ago in the kingdom of night, when it was taken back. Once again, the exiles are being gathered in. The knot is being knotted. The end is rejoining the beginning and justifying it. Over there in the camp, a wise and pious inmate had cried out in a fit of madness, "All of us heard God in the desert. Here we shall be allowed to see him." "Yes," the others had answered in the camps, "we shall see him and perish." The image of God cannot be transmitted. It can be carried away only in death. But here, it's man's image that is being transmitted. And in order to receive it, an entire people had begun to march for the third time in its history. And it continues. He sees victims of the Shoah coming as well, joining these throngs of people coming down to the Kotel right after the Six-Day War. Nothing could stop them, not even the divine will restraining the Messiah, for they have no tombs to hold them back, no cemeteries to bind them to the earth. They've come down from the sky, their cemetery is the sky, and their eyes are eternity and it's night. Israel's victory, a character says, echoing Eichmann trial prosecutor Gideon Hausner, but attributed to a real person Wiesel met at the wall shortly following its recapture. Israel's victory can be attributed to the fact that, quote, its army, its people could deploy 6 million more names in battle, end quote. What of people like David? Wiesel writes, and I think he's speaking broadly, and the survivor in all this, he will end up writing his request, which he will slip between the cracks in the wall. Addressed to the dead, it will ask them to take pity on a world which has betrayed and rejected them. Being powerful and vindictive, they can do whatever they please, punish or even forgive. End quote. I'd like to propose that in the time that the novel Dawn takes place, between the Shoah and the founding of the state, Wiesel depicts a moral universe, bereft of forgiveness, characterized by the grim choices facing those who fought for Israel's right to exist. Moreover, I would suggest that he needed to present this image as the ground upon which later characterizations could be built. He needed to establish this idea first in his fiction, so that later he could build this concept of the hybrid, the dual Israeli-European Jew, the Jew of the diaspora, merged together with the new Zionist Jew, as if to declare that this identity is also our history, and anyone who might come later to criticize needs to know it. Only after this is established can Wiesel write A Beggar in Jerusalem, which represents a more complex and more full attitude towards Israel. The hybrid survivor persona is there, but so too are the state and a renewed messianic vision. Both novels depict the theme of sacrifice. Elisha will offer his morality. David offers his life. And both end up surviving these new trials. Dawn and A Beggar in Jerusalem offer two different accounts at two different times of Israel's own rebirth. One is described as terrorist murder. The other is described as heroic battle. Both became foundational for the author's views on Israel. And the ghosts of the Holocaust haunt both of them. The late Holocaust scholar Terence Dupré writes that Wiesel, in both volumes, directs his attention away from the Shoah directly and towards Israel, and the relation between the European catastrophe and the birth of the Jewish state. But then he corrects himself. And he says, for certainly Dawn and Beggar in Jerusalem are about the Holocaust. So much so that without clear knowledge of the Holocaust, the reader will make little sense of either book. And this, I think, is one of the essential characteristics of Wiesel's writing. It's the product of an artist who's also present in his own work as a witness, and its power resides in the way, either by allusion or brief reference or strategic omission, Wiesel makes the sheer fact of the Holocaust the omnipresent, we might say even omnipotent, background for everything else. The Holocaust in Wiesel's work is absolute and the point from which all else shall be measured. It's so absolute that, like God, it need not be mentioned. It's just there. A monolithic presence against which all human endeavor, spiritual, historic, artistic, meets its boundary. That, I wish I'd written that. It was Terence Dupré. I didn't write that. So this is not meant to be an apology or a defense. It's a diagnosis. Wiesel writes from his experience of the Holocaust. When people criticized him before and after his death for disappointing them, for having a blind spot when it comes to Israel, they know this. But they believe that the Holocaust teaches a universal lesson, which it does, and that anyone who learns that lesson can or should speak up for oppression wherever or whenever it appears. And that may be true for many, but it's not for everyone. There's another lesson, a harder one to receive and convey. That the Holocaust teaches vigilance and necessity, and above all, defense of one's own community. First and foremost. My colleague, the philosopher Zachary Braderman, has noted, quote, "For Wiesel, no value was more paramount than Jewish survival, which he understood to be the best of his limit. To the best of his limit. For Wiesel, Israel meant something very deep by way of a precarious solace after so much destruction and death. From a position of perpetual vulnerability, Wiesel could identify the moral limits of Jewish power, but he could not speak truth to Jewish power. One can only be disappointed in a person from whom one expects too much, in whom one has invested too much in the first place." End quote. So in the end, Israel comes to represent an additional complex layer of identity for the author and his characters. It symbolizes one side of the dual identity conundrum. Wiesel and many of his characters are Holocaust survivors, but they're also Zionist Jews. This entwined identity cannot be unraveled, and it impacts their real and imagined views of the world. Ironically, the notion of dual identity is precisely one thing anti-Semites fear and use as an excuse for their hatred of us. On this Kristallnacht, we must live it proudly in defiance of their threats. Thank you. If you need to go, please. I'm happy to take questions if you have a few more minutes. Yes, please.
Wasn't there an actual case where I think the Irgun executed two British sergeants?
Yeah.
Is that what it's based on?
I don't know for a fact that it is, but...
And Dolf Brunner was killed.
Yeah, I mean, it's... Yeah.
It's a what if.
Yeah, I mean, again, he wrote it later on, right? Yes. All of this was known.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean,
So I figured it was based on it.
Any other questions, comments?
No.
Thank you. Have a good evening. Shavua